Hi there. Welcome to the Agency Toolkit Podcast, a podcast where we discuss stories, strategies, and techniques to help you build a successful and profitable digital marketing agency. Our episodes contain inspiring conversations with CEOs and entrepreneurs and leave you with actionable tips, ideas, and strategies you can implement into your business today. We are happy to have you with us. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and get inspired.
Hey, Julia here. If you'd like to grow your agency with a new free traffic source, we've put together a free resource for you called the Agency Traffic Blueprint, which outlines how you can acquire free organic traffic for your agency's website using Powered by Marketing. You can get that at getrubyrobin.com/blueprint or check the description of this episode for the link.
Hello, and thank you for tuning into another episode of the Agency Toolkit. I am your host, Julia McLaughlin. My guest today is John Evans, who is the owner and founder of Gen M Creative and Frank, two Oklahoma City-based advertising agencies that have serviced a variety of clients over the last 9 years. Today, we're going to be discussing John's journey of building his agency and what he's learned along the way. So thanks so much for joining us today, John.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
So to get started, let's dive into a couple questions so our listeners can get to know you a little bit.
Okay.
So, you know, what would you say really motivates or inspires you as an entrepreneur?
That's such a funny thing. I think that your goals in life often shift as you grow and as you grow as an individual, and I think just grow in your career as well. I started an agency very early on in my life, about 21, 22. And, you know, back then the thought was, I want freedom. I want to be an entrepreneur because I want to break out of the chains. You know, I don't want to just work for somebody else my whole life. Yes. I was actually doing a sales job. And then I found out fairly quickly on that, hey, you're not really free. You still have clients. It's just the same as you have a boss. It's the same thing with a different label, right? It's a different mask for the same thing.
Exactly.
So, you know, I think over the years, a large part of what's changed is instead of this idea of freedom, I feel like I'm actually doing something worthwhile. You know, I think selling shoes at Dillard's at the local retail store I worked at, selling men's suits and, you know, dress clothes, wasn't really fulfilling. It wasn't something that really made me proud of a career or just, you know, and that's maybe good for some people, but I don't know. I've always been really kind of an outside of the box person. So,
yeah,
I really like being able to help people, and I like to be able to help, you know, I work a lot in, you know, very specific industries. So when you build enough knowledge in that area, it allows you as an agency to really move quicker on certain things and really help customers in a way that a lot of, you know, generalized agencies won't really have the expertise and the detail and the know-how. So I think that's what it is. I think just really being able to work in a way that is a little more fulfilling and, you know, whatever that looks like, that's fine by me.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, it's so rewarding when you feel like you're able to really, you know, make a difference in the lives of these small business owners at the end of the day. So Yeah, that's great. And then, so how did you get into digital marketing to start?
Oh, so that's an interesting story. So I mentioned earlier, I was working at a retail location and through various things between my boss and just the way things were going to that job, I wasn't really pleased. I kind of wanted to make a career shift. So somebody I knew that I'd met at a coffee shop like 2 years earlier had decided to start a video production company. And I, on a whim, I was already fed up. Like I said, I just said, I'll quit. So I just quit my job. Kind of a stupid move when I look back. I had a mortgage and a car payment and people relying on me to pay the bills. I probably wouldn't do it again if I had to go back and take a second run at it. But I was able to pull it off. I got a job account that was just like a little local bar that kind of replaced my income for that time period. And then I landed a fairly large casino that was actually only like 10 minutes from my house. Thank you. That was actually the real big jump for me because we were just offering video services at the time, but the marketing director I became pretty good friends with, and he really encouraged me to go out and really try to lean into advertising as opposed to the sort of mix of, you know, doing movies kind of, which is what my partner at the time wanted to do short films. He's like, no, lean into advertising. There's way more money there. And kind of led me down the path of that to the point where me and that partner eventually separated. But I kind of, you know, I had a third partner at the time that we'd started working together, and him and I carried on and really focused on the advertising, really, you know, got some local dealerships, hooked up with a local agency because we were just doing video at the time. Mm-hmm. So we didn't really compete in that fashion. And that was a good stepping stone for us because that got us a lot of experience working, you know, sort of in an agency, but also at our own beck and call when we wanted to.
Yes.
And I think over time, we eventually landed some large enough accounts that they then saw us as a competitor and was like, okay, no more. We're going to hire somebody else. But that's really the process of how we got from point A to point B. So
interesting. And then, so that was your original agency, and then that was called Gen M Creative, I believe. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. And then, so now you are running Frank. So talk a little bit about, you know, what it was like in those early days when you were first starting out with Frank.
Sure. Yeah. So one of the things with Gen M was that not only were we known as being a production house, we did video, we would do graphic design, websites, right? But we weren't really known for being a branding and a strategy agency.
Right.
And, you know, I think the name Gen M also came from abbreviation for Generation Millennial, because when we started the agency, I was like 22, 23. I was very young. Yeah. So I found it very difficult to get, you know, your older audience, which is generally who your marketing directors are, you know, they're in their 50s, 40, 50, 60s. It was hard to convince them to give me large budgets. So as opposed to, because I was a kid, you know, I'm just being honest, I was very young. So yes. as opposed to trying to hide that, we just leaned into it and we said, you know, if you want to market to boomers or if you want to market to Gen X, flip open any book written in the last 20 years, flip to page 42 and just follow the rules, right? But if you want to market to millennials, how better to do that than through a team of millennials? Hi, I'm John, I'm with Gen M. So with those being kind of where we niched ourselves out, I always thought that brand's value would expire about the time that millennials became marketing directors. So I figured I had about a 15-year shelf life. And had kind of always looked for a day where it made sense for us to try to rebrand or, you know, possibly start another agency. And I think all the cards fell in place. We got a very large national account. They were in 8 states, 128 stores. And cool. It was just a thank you. And it was a good opportunity for us to use their connection because they were a retail location and we worked with their vendors a lot. So as opposed to trying to push Gen M as this, you know, regional little boutique agency that's sort of just a production house, we thought, no, let's not scrap it because it's still got staying power, but let's make a new agency, really build a brand on strategy and branding. And that's kind of where Frank was born. So we could go to more of a national level.
Okay, interesting. So when you were first, you know, starting out with Frank, what were some of those, you know, challenges that you had to overcome whenever you were making the transition from Gen M over to Frank?
Sure. I know one of the first one is something I feel like every agency deals with is, although we all do marketing for a living, we're really bad at marketing ourselves. Yes. And I see that so commonly. You know, a lot of it was just getting the ground rules and really the basis for what a brand looks like and really trying to separate the brand, because we had scaled pretty considerably from, I think we had, you know, 5 or 6 employees at the time before we got that large account. Scaled up to, you know, 12 employees and 6 contractors in a matter of a few months.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that process was, So trying to learn the new ground rules when you go from really that little tiny boutique agency to, you know, a little bit more closer to like mid-sized agency, was a big jump for us. And I think that was probably the hardest thing, figuring out how to operate properly, figuring out how to really lean on what we knew about brand and what we knew about strategy development and media. Because we just didn't make that an integral part of, you know, our company when we were just Gen M. So I think that was one of the key things that really took a while. And once we figured out some processes, got some SOPs in place, I think developed a really good core team. We started working on building out the brand, then building a website. And again, that was just a long process because you're trying to satisfy this new account and it's all still kind of new and fresh in that area because you're not really, you know, you've not had that much experience at this level before.
Yep.
And not that you don't, you know, we had plenty of accounts at the time, but managing all of those accounts was basically like having one of these. So we basically doubled the size of our agency in terms of account load.
Yeah, and it sounds like it.
Yeah. So I think that was just really the big thing that took us a while. And then of course, so that was 2019. The very next year, COVID hits. Everything starts shutting down. We lucked out with them because they were cannabis. So they were considered you know, an essential business, and we're allowed to stay open because it was medical cannabis.
Got it.
But even that still hurt them. They still had a lot of reliance on CBD, other CBD stores.
Yeah.
And just over time, it got to the point where the marketing budget just shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. Mm-hmm. And we inadvertently went through this process. Both those companies are closed now, but we inadvertently went through a downsizing process again, which in the long term was good because we got the opportunity to, you know, really build back up in a way that was strategic, as opposed to scrambling, trying to make everything work in the short time that we had.
Interesting. Okay. So how do you grow the agency? So how are you consistently bringing in leads into your agency and then closing those prospects?
Yeah. So we have what I would consider in a lot of cases, unorthodox methods. I wouldn't say, you know, with Oklahoma being such a small, especially Oklahoma City being such a small community, and it's not tiny, it's 1.4 million people. But just the business community is very tight niche, you know, everybody knows everybody.
Right.
And it was really I think in the early days, we leaned on our agency partnership to drive leads and make connections and meet people. And then as we were able to establish, we really leaned on our client to help drive in business. So one of our forefront things is always, you know, we really want to build strong client relations. I'd rather have 10 accounts that I have for a lifetime than 10 new accounts every month. You know, it's just much more stable, and you build, you know, your reputation is solely based on what your clients say about you. So I think the core part is just delivering really good service and, you know, really trying to create brand ambassadors out of our clients that we work with now. Outside of that, we also do things like, my partner actually organizes like concerts and events on the side. He started doing that in the last couple of years.
Okay.
And we use that as a way to, because we tend to have a tendency to bring in vendors who will pay like a vendor fee, and, you know, they'll work, they show the products. It's sort of like an expo/concert.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a way for us to really get in with a large network of companies without necessarily, you know, and that's not something we did intentionally. It just kind of was something that fell in his lap. Somebody he knew was already doing it, and they started working together on it, but it has helped us build a big network in that particular type of client for us.
Interesting.
And I think the second thing really is, you know, trying to focus on doing speaking engagements, things like this, you know, build a reputation for yourself. We've tried various things. We actually started a podcast, which we did 3 episodes and I broke my arm and we put it on hold.
oh no.
It was a silly accident. You know, the Lime scooters.
Yep.
I fell riding one of those. The car.
Oh, that sounds awful.
Yeah, I didn't realize how hard it was to edit in the cast until I had to try it for 6 weeks. And I was like, you know what, we'll just pick this up another day. But and then we do lean a lot on digital funnels. So we, you know, work with companies like Clutch. We make sure that we try to work really, a strong presence on, platforms similar to Clutch or what's the other one we use that's really popular, Design Rush. Really trying to just drive leads, you know, as a sort of substitute for what we do organically. And then of course, you know, we're members of the chamber. We go to a lot of networking events. We have a good networking, you know, conglomerate that we're involved with that we go out and spend a lot of time to, you know, introduce ourselves, meet people, et cetera. So,
yeah, it sounds like a very well-rounded approach that you take to acquiring new business. So that's really interesting.
You know, it's one of those things where agencies are so, it can be funny trying to help clients see the value of an agency a lot of times. And it's either they completely don't value it at all, and they just really need something specialized that they, you know, can't do in-house, or they, you know, don't really know anybody who they want to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's they absolutely value it, and those are few and far between. So having somebody who wants to have a really good, healthy working relationship can be hard to find sometimes. And I think really casting a wide net is kind of the key to success there. You don't really limit yourself and be willing to try things that are new and different. And you know, you never know what's going to work out and what's not.
Yeah. So I know you spoke a little bit about, you know, turning your clients into brand ambassadors to bring in those referrals for your agency. So what are some ways that you create really happy clients who are going to, you know, talk about you and bring in those referrals at the end of the day?
Of course. Yeah. One of the things that I see so frequently that other agencies, I think, fall down on. And even when I work with other companies who are vendors, of my clients that I have to work with is communication. Communication is so key. You know, with what we do, things can be so variable. You know, I have an instance right now where a client had asked us to go out and build out a new brand for them for a new product line they're going to carry. Mm-hmm. We got approval from everybody in the company, and we're about 3/4 of the way done with it. And, you know, the CEO comes back and he's like, I don't really like it. I want to make some changes. It's like, well, we're already 3/4 of the way done. Like, that's fine, you know, but the communication element is really kind of what broke down there a little bit, because he was busy. He had other things going on and wasn't really able to spend a lot of time with us. So I think that's really where that happened. But I see that happen so often with companies. And because of delays like that, if you communicate with a client, 9 times out of 10, they're okay. You know, if you can talk to them fairly frequently, at least 2-3 times a week, make sure that they know what's going on, that their team knows what's going on. Their clients can be a lot more forgiving of delays than if they try to reach out to you, they don't hear you for 2 weeks, and then you're behind on your deadlines. You know, communication is the most important part, in my opinion. And can make up for a lot of downfalls on the agency side. Outside of that, I think, you know, really being able to understand clients is one of the second most valuable things. And probably I would say it competes with, you know, spot number one. Mm-hmm. We have a process building brands that's sort of proprietary to us. We built it out. We have a handful of questions when we do our client interviews. And we really look at ourselves as translators. You know, we translate what the client thinks of themselves and who they are and what they stand for, and try to communicate that through design and through, you know, internal voices, external voices, just general overall. We lean on archetypes a lot. Mm-hmm. Something that somebody we were affiliated with, actually that marketing director I mentioned earlier, introduced us to a company he used to work with, and a guy wrote a book on that. And
very cool.
That really, thank you. That really helps us, I think, as an agency. At the end of the day, what we do is we just pick up what the client says and we just feed it back to them the exact same way they delivered it to us, but we do it through design. So when they see what we produced, it's what they asked for, even though they didn't ask for it directly, you know? So I feel like a lot of failings, people will say, okay, you wanted the design, you wanted the logo, here's your brand. And then the client looks at it and they're like, okay, well, I don't like this, I don't like that, you know, because they subjectively don't have any reason to believe anything or don't necessarily see the same vision that your designers had while creating that piece. But when you sit them down and take a little extra time and say, you said you like this, that's why we included this. And you said that you like this, and that's why we've included this. And here's what all that looks like when you add it all up. Clients love it. So it's really
just being able to— Yeah, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, it's just fine tuning that element of, you know, what the client doesn't know they want, because they wouldn't be hiring you if they did, you know?
Well, and it makes so much sense, because people just want to feel heard at the end of the day as well. You know, it's so frustrating when you're spending your budget on marketing and, you know, you don't feel like your vision's been heard. So, you know, it all comes back to just that communication, clearly managing those expectations. And I love that the way that you guys communicate that, I think it makes so much sense to just make your client, allow them to feel heard.
Yeah, thank you. There was a what do they call them, a dramedy sitcom or whatever, a dramedy that came on a little while back. I only watched the first episode of it, but in it, one of the guys is running as a politician, and somebody tells him, just tell people when they come to you and they're complaining, they don't really want an answer, they just want to be heard. And, you know, I it's funny, because we had kind of perfected that process internally before I had saw that. But when I saw that, I was like, I understand why clients really appreciate what we do. And it's just because we do, you're right. I mean, we listen to them and we hear what they have to say.
Yeah.
And they feel good knowing they're getting back what they asked for, which I think can be really hard for most people to identify when they are trying to do things like that. Marketing's so abstract, you know?
Yes.
And you can sell them on results, but a lot of times people have their own opinions too. So you can claim, well, this brand will do this, or we'll be able to market and capture this. And those things are important, in my opinion. But I also think helping the person understand that they're getting exactly what they asked for, and then letting them visually see it, is really the thing that pulls it all together. It helps really build, I think, strong relationships with clients.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. So what would you say? I know you mentioned in the early days, you know, putting those processes together was a big challenge that you had to overcome when you were scaling so quickly. What would you say has been, you know, the biggest overall challenge that you've had to overcome as you've been growing Frank?
Oh, yeah, that's a mixed bag. I would say probably the biggest problem we had was finding a balancing act between what side of the business you really need to develop at any given time. Mm-hmm. Because I look at agencies as sort of being two wings of the same bird, one really being your creative team. And I think this is a common trope, but you have your creative team who, they're the video, they're the website, they're the graphic design, they're the, various other, photography, et cetera. And then you have really the what feels like more business oriented, it's accounts team, it's, in bookkeeping and your financials and really just trying to drive new business and manage new business. The thing that I found that we struggled with in the beginning was finding a good balance between that, because I believe it's good policy to always have your owners or your partners of the company be the primary new biz dev drivers. Mm-hmm. No one's ever going to sell your agency quite as well as you will. And
yes, totally.
I feel like, I'm not going to say it can't work out, but hiring account reps solely for the purpose of account reps can be very difficult to, I think, because usually, you're going to pay them a commission plus, you got to pay them a salary as well. And it takes time to get them in the same mindset and understand how to sell you. And it depends on where they come from. If they come from another agency, that probably makes it easier. If you were able, maybe say you took them from poached them from a news station or, one of your local media conglomerates. They're gonna be really handy on the media side, but it will take them time to transition from really that corporate, media sales environment to really understanding the dynamics of an agency. So because of that, it's hard, I feel like, or we had a hard time at first really figuring out where the balance was, because we would go out and sell the agency and land new accounts. Then we'd have to develop the creative team to handle that workload, right?
Yeah.
And manage that influx of work. And then you end up overhiring a little bit, but it's because of the diversity of work. It's not that you necessarily overhiring, but simply that you need certain things that maybe are too much to make sense to contract out, on a one or two off gig.
Yeah.
But, still leaves... I like to look at hours as, products on the shelf, right? So still leaves 80 hours on the shelf that, aren't being sold every month that A, you can use to help sell yourself, but then being able to make sure you're not getting too heavy on the time you're reallocating for your sales team to be able to manage it, especially when you're small and you only have two partners working on that. And just trying to keep that delicate balance, because there was a point where I think, we looked at it during that initial growth phase and, we had 12 people, 10 of them were creative team,
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And the workload was increasing and our books were becoming more complicated and we were using contractors to manage that stuff. And because we hadn't scaled that out, it's like the cost was inflating. So the money we were spending meant we had to go get new work or figure out how to drive that down. And when you're moving so fast paced like that, it's hard to really, you have to step back and look at it and say, okay, where am I actually falling down here? Where is the pinch point that I'm not seeing? And when you really come through the books and look at the numbers and get a better idea of, okay, well, we're just very payroll heavy on this side and we need to, maybe cut some cost here and really drive forward on new accounts and make sure we're using the hours that we have. And, accounts come and go, especially when you do project-based work. Retainers are handy, but project-based work, you may get a lot of projects that keep you very busy, and then winter hits and it drops off. And now you have an extra 200-300 hours a year, a month that you're paying for. That it's like, well, I got to find a place for those. We need to dedicate some of those resources to ourselves, some of it to our new business, et cetera. So
is that something that you would say that you've overcome at this point? Ensuring that there's not dead time within the agency. Or is that, an ongoing, just something that, you tackle day by day?
Yeah. Yes. That's, that's actually been a subject matter. I don't think it ever goes away. I think it's something you constantly revisit. Because when we scale down, every time that you have to scale up or scale down, it's kind of like starting over in that sense, in this sort of where the balance lies. And when we scaled down because of COVID, we really started recovering last year and beginning of this year, really got back on our feet, really had to start rehiring. We're up to 10 employees right now with one contractor that we don't know. We have two, but we mostly primarily leverage one contractor.
Nice.
And I think that something that helped there was because we were able to do it so intentionally this time, instead of really rapid fire, you know, clawing our way up the mountain just to keep things afloat. We've been much more efficient this time around. There was a lot of waste that first time on our part, just from where, you know, our processes weren't fine-tuned enough that we'd end up having to make revisions, do things, you know, a couple times over, just because internal communication wasn't that good. Right. And it wasn't anything that ever really bugged the client or bothered the client, but internally it took us a lot longer and a bigger expenditure of resources to really, I think, deliver the level of work that was expected of us. So having kind of fixed that problem along the way, you know, rescaling back up to where we are now, I think really what you see a lot of times is, you know, we're having the same conversation right now. The last month, we've really been looking at numbers and kind of figuring out where things stand. And we're like, okay, we need to figure out how to manage more of the project management side. We need to figure out how to, you know, when you're the principals doing the sales, but then you're scaling back up from, you know, where we went from, you know, 18 total people to 3 in that time period because of COVID. Yeah, we almost got rolled over by COVID pretty hard. But in that sort of scaling process back up, you know, we took over the books again, and we took over, you know, managing project management. We took over payables, and we took over all the responsibilities that had been delegated out properly. So it's like, what point makes sense to relinquish those to a role? And that's something we've been looking at recently, is let's hand off a lot more of this administrative stuff and really get back to driving new business, because we're at a point where we have a strong creative team, but we're kind of in that same boat where we don't have a strong accounts and, you know, business management team right now. And being able to, you know, we recently just brought somebody, we had somebody who already worked in the company that we've kind of transitioned her into being our project manager, and she's handling, you know, projects and billables and, you know, our hours and timekeeping management. That's so important. It's so important, and it's easy to overlook, and really having strong processes there, that helps a lot too. But you know, being able to kind of do that, and we've been able to, we're looking at probably bringing in another accountant soon. We've been paying an accountant team to, you know, manage our books, but it's getting to the point where, is it really cost effective because of the amount of hours we're paying them versus, you know, they're $105 an hour, or $115, I think they are. So it's not, you know, the cost benefit ratio is really starting to taper off. And I think that always kind of exists. I don't think that ever really goes away, depending on how large you scale, because I know even large agencies, although they feel it less, I have many friends who have large agencies as well, and they struggle with the same thing sometimes, which is just, where do I keep the balance and really managing the resources, you know, in the proper way?
Yeah, it's just something that you have to constantly be reassessing and making sure that your team is as efficient as they can possibly be, and that you're, you know, being as economical as possible.
100%, yes. Yeah. And we do take into consideration some time, you know, we don't, when we look at the hours when we hire an employee, we don't consider that 100% shelvable items, right? We don't consider the 160 hours a month as being our actual stock. We knock off 30% from the top. We consider 70% of the allowable hours should be billable at maximum, with at least 10 of those being dedicated to our own marketing resources and building our own brand. 10 of those being built for, you know, business development, business management, you know, and kind of also we include that extra 10% for revisions. So revisions, changes, you know, maybe it's a deal where we want to do something good for the client, they want something different, we don't want to bill them. So to help build that relationship, that's, you know, and make them feel really good about working with us, we kind of build that in to our expectations in our hiring process. And then we do just account 10% for just a loop time, you know, 10% for cultural things, you know, keeping the environment fun and lighthearted. And if we aren't working to our nose to the grindstone 100% of the time from 9 to 5, 9 to 6, that's okay. You know, we don't mind taking a little time and really giving a comfortable environment where we can all play, and just making sure that, you know, our hourly rate reflects that and can cover us at a 70% margin, as opposed to, you know, 100% trying to make sure we're running 100% of billable hours all the time. Cause that's just, you can't, it's really hard to build a strong team that way. And it's very difficult to keep good people. You know, the longer somebody's in your agency, the much more efficient they become as a, you know, as a designer or a developer or whatever that job role might be.
Yeah.
So it seems counterintuitive at first that you would just take 10% time for just, you know, goof time, but at the end of the day, it saves you retraining another employee every, you know, 6 months because they found a better job they feel more comfortable and happy working in.
So. Yeah, I agree 100%. Yeah. Taking that time to just, you know, it's good for morale. It's good for your team. You know, it's going to keep them happy. And like you mentioned, you know, happy employees are going to be more loyal and they're just going to stick with your agency for longer, and I'll save you training someone else down the road.
Right. Right. Plus some members will become core members of your team. You know, we have designers that we have three graphic designers right now, wouldn't trade for the world. And they, as designers, you know, Steven's been with us the longest. He actually was one of the few that made it through the COVID layoffs and everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, he has done really good in terms of he's become very skilled at project management and hour management, time management on his own. So he really, you know, has been moved into, he still does design work, but he also does a lot of hands-on client work, deals with the client, does client presentations. He is, you know, kind of our art director in that regard.
Interesting.
He's very good at managing the team. He's also their supervisor. So because we've had him so long and we're so comfortable working together, it's easy for him to, you know, he's had enough time to really understand where we fit and where, you know, where his time is best spent. And he's had time to develop those skills. So
right. That,
you know, was sort of a nice way for us to take some load off of us as we were scaling back up. Cause otherwise me and my partner, Yosuke, we would have done that whole process on our own.
Right.
So, and manage all those things on top of everything else we had going on, which would have been a nightmare in some regards. So,
yeah. So where do you see Frank in 5 years time?
You know, one thing that I do want to really keep developing, I know we talked about this briefly before the meeting, but we really got in the CBD industry. Mm-hmm. And is it fine if I talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So we got into the CBD industry back in 2015. And this is another tip that I would hand out to anybody who's listening, is that be willing to take shots in the dark and kind of think creatively about the types of industries you want to go after.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 2015, they passed a bill here which legalized CBD in Oklahoma, and that was the Katie and Cayman's Law. And then, you know, 3 years later, they passed the farm bill that made it federally legal. But the Katie and Cayman's Law opening up a CBD market here seemed like a smart move for us to try to get into as a specific niche business industry. Because my prognostication was that we would go from CBD to a medical THC, like so many states were, you know, in the process of doing or had already done at the time. And that eventually leading to what I would consider, you know, into the prohibition era type of market for a certain type of product. You know, if you look at, you know, at 1930s legitimate prohibition, I would have loved to had A and B beverage before they were A and B, right? Having Anheuser-Busch would have been an incredible account if I would have had them 30 years before they were Budweiser, and, you know.
Yes.
So looking at that, I'm like, well, here's a very rare opportunity to get into that, because this doesn't come along very well. And we already know there's high demand for the product, just like during Prohibition. People would have speakeasies. They would go and hide in the back of someone's house and sit around and have a little private bar and drink with their friends, which is kind of the same thing you're dealing with within cannabis. So there's already a built-in demand for it. There's no doubt in my mind it's going to be a large industry. And, you know, what I would like to see over the next 5 years, we've kind of rooted ourselves so well in that industry that I would like to see us become one of the largest, most well-known agencies. I feel like we're really far out ahead of most companies, and we do have national reach. We have clients all over the East Coast, West Coast. We just closed our first Canadian account in Vancouver this last week.
Congrats.
So I really, thank you. I'd like to see us just become a full household name in cannabis. And, you know, we also focus on hospitality and tourism. We have a chain of Marriott's that we work with, Marriott Hotels.
Cool. Yeah.
So we have about 14 of them, and they're considered the Autograph Collection. They're ambassador hotels owned by the Marriott.
Okay.
So they're all these really gorgeous boutique environments. You know, Kansas City was made out of an old bank, and just down here, they recently opened the first National in downtown OKC. They actually have a bar that I went to last night called the Library of Distilled Spirits, and it's built into their old bank vault.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, that sounds so cool.
Yeah. So I would like, Sorry, we have office dogs.
Oh, it's all good.
So yeah, I would like to see us really continue to develop that and really become a household name in both of those. I think industries, and maybe expand in other places, but I'm a firm believer of do what you do best, you know? So if you have a lot of experience in something, don't try to compete on things you don't know much about.
Yeah. I love that you were able to identify, you know, those trends and really, you know, think ahead and establish yourself as a leader in that market. And you guys are just going to continue to, you know, conquer that vertical.
You know, I wish I could say that it was an epiphanous moment and it's, you know, the one true big home run, the, you know, option that I saw, but really I tried a lot of things. You know, I saw a lot of little niche markets. I'm like, we should try this. We should try getting to franchise marketing. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, franchise marketing seemed like a good opportunity. I've seen that Oklahoma City was developing in a pretty rapid way. And we were seeing a lot of interest from franchise models coming in. So I thought, well, if we niche that out, and it really just comes down to, you know, we took 5 shots in the dark and one of them stuck. And if you're always doing things like that and you're really forward thinking and how you're doing that, when you hit big on one, you're set.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, that's awesome. Well, we are getting ready to wrap up here shortly, but first we have the Fast 5. So I've got 5 rapid fire questions for you.
All right.
So what's a book you've read that's made an impact on you?
You know, it's hard to pin down because I am a pretty avid reader. I have a expansive library of Audible books. I would probably say the book that I mentioned earlier, it's Story Branding 2.0 by Jim Signorelli. He used to own ESW Story Labs out of Chicago.
Yep.
And I think that just the archetypal analysis was really important for us to sort of break down brands. And I think it goes beyond just building brands. It's also understanding your clients as well. So we have a tendency that, you know, when we're building out brands, we do the internal and external voice. And a lot of that internal voice is basically who the customer and the client is. So we can really look at that and understand our client as we're building content for our client. So I think sort of that analysis process helps us really, you know, learn how to talk with them, how to present things to them, things they're going to like, things they're not going to like, you know. I would say that's probably one of the more, one of the biggest impacts that a book would have had out on me over the years.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Very cool. And what does your morning routine look like?
Okay, so I'm a little bit more of a night owl than probably your usual guest. So, you know, I'm not an Elon Musk grind, wake up at 4 a.m., do squats or anything. I usually wake up sometime between 7 and 8 in the morning. I get up, I kind of, you know, start the day off. I try to account for East Coast because we have some contractors on the East Coast that we work with.
Yes.
So, I try to start around 7-8 o'clock in the morning, make client calls, make vendor calls if I need to, really get in the office, have a Red Bull breakfast, which I probably should cut out, but I do it every day.
I'll give you a solid start to the day.
Right. And then, you know, I'm kind of old fashioned. We have so many tools internally to use. We use Asana, you know, for like project management and scheduling purposes, but I'm kind of old fashioned. I like to just sit down and kind of plan out my day with pen and paper just so I can see it. And it's always referenceable right there on a notepad on my desk.
Yeah.
So, just kind of dig in and plan out my day and then see where it goes. You know, it's the agency life, right? So 9 a.m., everything's going smooth, and 9:15, you got a dumpster fire to go take care of.
You never know.
Yeah, never know.
Is there a CEO that you follow or study?
You know, that's kind of funny. I would say if I had to pick one, it would probably be, I really appreciate Steve Madden's story. He did a really good podcast with Dax Shepard on Armchair Experts. His story of how he got to where he was in life, how he ended up going to jail over that Wolf of Wall Street, insider trading, whatnot that happened, and and then getting out and really coming back and rebuilding the business up. You know, it was kind of failing by the time he got out of jail. Was able to turn into a $2 billion company. I do really appreciate his story. I would say if I had to pick one, that would be one of the ones I pay attention to most. But I usually find that, you know, watching kind of CEOs and the way that they approach business gives you a good roadmap, but it doesn't really tell you how to deal with, I think, what becomes like the personal stress and the emotional stress that comes along with trying to lead and manage and run and deal with the, you know, internal politics and external politics. And, you know, I feel like I would probably say I follow and study more Stoics than I do CEOs, just because, you know, the old phrase that you can only control what you can control, I think really helps when you, you know, when you understand that all these decisions that you see that, you know, the CEOs and their business practices are useful, but is it good for you? Are you going to be able to work with that? Is that something you really want? If that's in your control, you know, what value can you actually take out of it? And, you know, how is it going to help you grow your business, grow yourself personally? And, you know, ultimately, is it going to be something that you can look back in 10 years and in good faith say, I'm proud of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And what is your favorite online tool?
I would say, you know, this would have recently changed. I think probably my favorite online tool, which we don't use for the agency, I'm really amazed by the technology itself, is OpenAI's DALL-E 2. I put in for the beta. Are you familiar with DALL-E?
No, I'm not.
It's very interesting. It is a deep learning neural AI that essentially turns verbal prompts into 3D CGI generated images. So you can go in and say, yeah, first time I signed up for the beta probably about 6 months ago, I got accepted about 2 months ago. I think the first thing I tried was, what would a Yorkie golden doodle hybrid look like, with a blue ball sitting on a desk next to it. And it generated 4 images that look like a Yorkie golden doodle hybrid with a blue ball on a table next to it.
Wow. And that's so cool.
Yeah, it is really interesting technology. I think it's going to probably drastically shift the creative market over the years.
Yeah.
And I mean, some of the details and some of the things, I asked for a cast iron skillet in the dishwasher, and it gave me a rusted cast iron skillet sitting in the dishwasher. And it has a paint-in option. So I circled out a section and said, with a red apple in the middle. And then when I hit export, it gave me 4 new images, all with an apple sitting on the center of the cast iron skillet where I had painted. Yeah. And they do outpainting too. You can take pictures and just tell it to go larger, and it'll take, you know, ancient, like take Renaissance paintings and just expand what it thinks would have been if the picture had been 3 times the size it is right now. So
wow,
it's really fascinating technology.
Yeah, absolutely. Very cool. And last question, what's one thing you wish you had known when you began your career?
Oh, let's see. Yeah, I would say, there's a lot of things I could say that I wish I knew. I think the most important one would have been, if I really had to put a pin in it, probably don't be afraid to focus on yourself. Don't be afraid to focus on your happiness. I know, you know, first 7 years of working in this industry, running my own agency, I did not take a vacation. I didn't take a vacation for 7 years. I worked Monday through Friday, sometimes Saturday, sometimes Sunday. I missed personal things. I missed family events, you know, opportunities and things I would never get back. And I don't necessarily regret any of those things. I'm not one to really regret the choices I make in life, but I would say that if I had a chance to run at it again, I would probably try to prioritize those moments a little bit more, because there's always tomorrow, right?
But find a little bit more balance.
Yeah. Work-life balance is something that's so easy to forget about, especially when, you know, you are an entrepreneur. And I think that one of the things too is that eventually burnt me out to the point where I was very unproductive. So consider I probably lost 1.5 years of what I could have done in my career if I had just taken off a couple of weeks a year, you know, or just a little bit of time here and there. So I would probably say make sure that you pay attention to your work-life balance, because it's very easy to get caught up in everything, and the stress can definitely take it out of you. And, you know, I always looked at it as, we don't necessarily have to be the best. We just have to outlast the rest. There's a lot of companies that we worked that were, you know, little small agencies that we knew about. And over the years, they just, you know, they couldn't make it. They got burnt out. They got tired. And would just close up shop and go about their way and, you know, return to, you know, maybe a career or whatever it is that they want to do, try something different. But had it not been for us having a pretty solid foundation, that might have been us. I mean, both me and my partner got fairly burnt out at one point. And you know, I think that make sure you're maintaining that work-life balance, because especially in those big expansion phases like we did with that CB Plus account I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Those were some of the most trying times. And I think I'd probably been a little better off if I had mentally taken care of myself in the years prior to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's so important to just know your limits and, you know, schedule those breaks and schedule that time so that you can go, you know, exercise and just take the time you need as well, because you'll just be playing the long game at the end of the day, whenever you, you know, take care of yourself.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, John. It was a pleasure to have you on the show, and I've really enjoyed learning about your story. And yeah, thank you again for joining me.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Agency Toolkit. We hope you've learned something new that you can implement into your agency today. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to our podcast, and we'll see you next time.